Welcome to the IVF Journey with Dr. Michael Chapman, the podcast for couples who struggle with infertility and want to fulfill their dreams of becoming parents. In this podcast, you'll learn actionable strategies to deal with infertility from Dr. Michael Chapman, or Prof as he's affectionately known. Prof is the co-founder of IVF Australia and is a leading Australian infertility specialist who has helped over 3,000 couples realise their dreams of becoming parents. To access previous episodes packed with ideas, solutions and tips that actually work, head over to Dr. Chapman's IVF podcast on iTunes. You can also ask questions by contacting Dr. Chapman's rooms on 1-800-111-483 or by emailing him, michael.chapman@ivf.com.au.
That first cry of a baby born after the long journey of IVF remains one of the most beautiful experiences in the world. As an obstetrician and an IVF specialist, I've had the privilege of experiencing this over many thousands of times in my long career, but I still remain moved by each baby's first cry. It signifies the end of a long journey and the beginning of a new life. This is Professor Michael Chapman, co-founder of IVF Australia and host of the IVF Journey podcast. Thanks for tuning in. To access all the previous episodes, head over to my website, www.theivfjourney.com, and select IVF Journey Podcast from the navigation menu. You'll also be able to find the various services that we provide at IVF Australia. Hi there. Well, today we're going to talk about the uterus and the importance of the uterus in terms of getting pregnant and maintaining a pregnancy. The uterus is basically a organ of muscle. Those muscle fibers allow a pregnancy to occur because they relax and they grow once pregnancy is established. But it's more complex than a simple muscle. There are blood vessels and the structure of the blood vessels and their way in which they supply the uterus is vital to a normal pregnancy, establishing the pregnancy and carrying it on, because they are the interface between the placenta and maternal circulation through which all the ingredients, supplementation of the baby's growth are transferred to allow the baby to grow. The lining of the uterus, the internal lining of the uterus, is also a vital structure. It's an intriguing collection of cells that turn over every month. After each menstrual period, the lining cells grow, thickening up the lining of the womb, and then once ovulation has occurred under the influence of progesterone hormone coming from the ovary, the cells change in their structure, they form glands, and from those glands are secreted a whole range of growth factors and other nutrients which are going to allow an embryo to grow within the uterus. They promote the division of the cells within the new embryo. They are important in allowing the attachment of the embryo to the lining of the womb, and they're important in establishing the blood vessel communications that I talked about a moment ago, those communications that are so vital to the nutrition of the new embryo. The uterus, with its lining and muscle, therefore, is actually quite a complex organ and quite responsive to the various female hormones. I've mentioned already about the growth of the lining of the womb, which is under the influence of estrogen, the differentiation to those cells that are good for pregnancy, and the development of the glandular structures that produce all the goodies to get a pregnancy going, are under the influence of progesterone. That progesterone also plays a part in the development of the uterus itself to allow a pregnancy to occur. Being a muscular organ, that muscle contracts. Although women cannot feel their uterus contracting, what actually happens is that on a minutely to hourly basis, the uterus is actually contracting. The way you can see waves on ultrasound, waves of uterine activity. Once pregnancy is established and progesterone levels begin to rise, those muscular contractions decline. so allowing the pregnancy not to be expelled as it grows. The uterus obviously has attachments to the fallopian tube. So the fallopian tube runs down through the muscular tissue to reach the uterus at the top end of the uterine cavity. The sperm travels up through those openings into the fallopian tube, looking for the egg coming the other way in the middle of the cycle. Fertilization doesn't take place in the uterus. It takes place halfway down the fallopian tube. The normal anatomy of the uterus, the lining, and the fallopian tubes are therefore vital in allowing a pregnancy to occur. The uterus is an interesting structure from another perspective in that it really doesn't age. The uterus, even in a 50 or 60-year-old woman, can still carry a pregnancy provided it has the hormonal stimulation that we've talked about already. Obviously, that doesn't happen spontaneously in those old age women, but as you often read in the press of women in their 50s and 60s using donor eggs, being able to carry their own baby is because they've been supplemented with hormones to make the uterus think that it's young and far younger than the woman's actual chronological age. So the things that can go wrong with the uterus are distortion of the shape of the uterus, and that's can occur because of congenital abnormalities, you know, girls being born with an abnormally shaped uterus. There are words like bicornuate uterus, which refers to a inappropriate lack of separation of the two sides as the uterus forms in the embryo at around 8 to 10 weeks of pregnancy. These congenital abnormalities rarely cause infertility. They do, however, potentially cause problems once a pregnancy has established. They're associated with a much higher chance of miscarriage, particularly late miscarriage after 12 weeks of pregnancy, mainly because these abnormalities are associated with weakness of the neck of the womb. Late in pregnancy, these congenital abnormalities can lead to the baby being stuck in awkward positions and not being able to turn head first to head down through the birth canal. Other distortions to the uterus can occur because of the growth of fibroids. So fibroids are tumours of muscle. They occur in something like 30% of all women at some point in their life. So they're very, very common. Some racial groups have a much higher chance of suffering from fibroids. Women of Afro-Caribbean descent are significantly more likely to have fibroids than a Caucasian. Their contribution to infertility from distorting the uterus can be to block the fallopian tubes as they grow large and press upon the very narrow openings of the fallopian tubes into the uterus. Fibroids that protrude into the cavity of the uterus, because they are not normal muscle with the normal blood vessels flowing through them, can prevent normal attachment of an embryo to the uterus. That's associated with miscarriage, but probably also is associated with a reduction in fertility. And therefore, those fibroids, called submucosal fibroids, should be removed. And the evidence is supporting the use of hysteroscopic procedures, i.e. through the neck of the womb, to scrape away or burn away or cut away the fibroids that indent the uterus. There is actually very little evidence that myomectomy, that's taking out fibroids, for ones either within the wall of the uterus or on the outside of the uterus, make any difference to the chances of fertility. And in fact, those procedures may inhibit fertility because the scarring that subsequently follows those procedures may block the fallopian tubes or prevent eggs being released into the abdominal cavity by the scar tissue that's formed around the ovaries. The use of myomectomy is indicated, as I've said, for the submucosal fibroids and probably for those patients who've had repeated miscarriages, and therefore there is some value in having them dealt with. There are very large fibroids that should be removed for other reasons,
pressure on other organs, as well as potentially helping in relation to reducing miscarriage risk. Inside the uterus, the abnormalities that can interfere with fertility are scarring of the lining of the cavity of the uterus. This can follow curettes done for miscarriages or during investigative procedures, infection. Tuberculosis is the worst one, but you can get a chronic inflammation of the lining of the womb called endometritis, which will interfere with implantation. The worst case scenario with scarring leads to the obliteration of the uterine cavity called Asherman syndrome. Those cells that I talked about earlier that line the womb, that go through those physiological changes to actually be able to create a uterus that will accept a pregnancy, are deprived and from the cavity of the uterus, and without them, their obliteration will prevent a pregnancy occurring. It can be treated, dividing the adhesions from between the front and the back wall of the uterus, and then promoting regrowth of the endometrium, those cells that I was talking about, can occur. But it is a difficult condition to treat and should only be looked after by people who see this problem on a regular basis. There are specialists who have a particular interest in that area, and I'd always refer patients with Asherman syndrome to those particular specialists. The other issue in relation to the endometrium, which is very debatable, when we were struggling for reasons why infertility might occur, a lot of work was done looking at the changes in the lining of the womb in the second half of the cycle under the influence of progesterone. And what some people believe is that hormonal deficiency in progesterone can lead to failure of the steps essential for implantation to occur at the right time, called asynchrony. The evidence for this, as I said, is somewhat debatable, but hormone support in the second half of the cycle has been indicated as a possibility in women who persistently don't get pregnant, but who have no obvious cause for their infertility. More sophisticated technology is now being applied to this issue, and it appears that the optimal time for implantation, about 7 days after ovulation, is associated with genetic changes in the genes that are almost like a signature of the right time. And when that signature is wrong, when we look at those genes and the genes that are expressed, we sometimes, probably in 2-3% of cases, can say there is this specific issue that the embryo is arriving in the uterus at the wrong time. That's particularly important in IVF. We wait the publication of big randomized controlled trials to see whether rejigging the time of embryo transfer based upon those checks of gene expression will actually result in better pregnancy rates, and therefore be able to point to the fact that it's a real effect. Watch this space. In relation to the fallopian tubes, obviously, if they're blocked, then pregnancy cannot occur. That blockage of tubes was the original reason that IVF was developed, to bypass tubes that have been damaged by infection or surgery or endometriosis. Thus, a basic investigation we do in any infertile couple is to check for tubal patency, which can be done by X-ray, by ultrasound, or by a laparoscopy, an operative procedure. And in all three of those, what we're doing is pushing up fluid through the fallopian tube and seeing it come out the other end, either radio-opaque fluid or radio ultrasound reflective fluid or blue dye in the case of the laparoscopy. Tubes can be patent and still be damaged. They can still not allow normal fertilization to take place. Tubes can be dilated because of scarring to the tubes. They can be damaged because infection has wiped out the very sensitive cells on the surface of the fallopian tube, which are what will foster the growth of an embryo. And this is why tubal surgery, which can reinstate the plumbing, in other words, make them unblocked, is not very successful, because those cells that line the womb have probably also been damaged by the infection that's caused the actual blockage. So the uterus and the fallopian tubes probably contribute 20 to 30% of all infertility, and proper investigation of their normality is a vital part of the investigation of infertility. I hope this gives you a bit more understanding of that part of the journey.
And don't forget that you can access all the previous episodes by going to our website, www.theivfjourney.com, and select IVF Journey Podcast from the navigation menu.
Thank you for listening to The IVF Journey with Dr. Michael Chapman, the podcast which helps couples negotiate their way through the IVF journey, all the way to parenthood. You can also ask questions by contacting Dr. Chapman's rooms on 1-800-111-483 or by emailing him michael.chapman@ivf.com.au.